The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
The Jews begin to realize in desperation that they're in big trouble. So they start to play on the morale of the men. Now, Elazar ben Yair was a brilliant psychological tactician. Brilliant. Okay? So what does he do? Right? He knows that the people down below think that they're under siege, but they have huge storehouses here. Okay? They take food, eat half of a fig, and throw it off the mountain. There's a swimming pool that we're going to pass by. Herod built such brilliant water canal systems up here. There was water enough for a swimming pool. Elazar ben Yair had a specific group who were delegated to go into the pool every afternoon in the hottest time of the day and splash around and make as much noise as they could. Yeah. And they would yell to each other, Matale, Chaski, Matale! And the Roman soldiers down below, they could hear the Jews splashing around, driving nuts. They used to take their clothes and dip them in the water and then hang them out, splat, on the edges of the walls so that the Romans could see the water dripping off the clothing. Brilliant. Psychology. Okay? Eventually they complete the siege wall. The Jews are becoming desperate. So they begin in the middle of the night to take expeditions off the side of the mountain, run down into the Roman camp, wreak havoc, right? Do a little killing and head back up the mountain. The Romans can't chase them up the mountain. Once they get to the top of the mountain, they're safe. Now imagine you're a Roman legionnaire, sleeping in your bed. You're in one of those base camps. And the Jews come off the mountains, and they just bring arrows. And they just start shooting arrows down into the camp. And you fall asleep in your bed. And who says all of them had beds? And they found all these arrowheads that they realized were the same arrowheads that they had found up here, Herodian arrowheads, in some of the base camps on this side. So they think that what they did was they used to climb down the mountain. You'll see there's another path down this side, which is basically like sort of more of a staircase. So they went down, did some havoc, killed some soldiers. They were banking on the fact that eventually, look, how long can the Roman legionaries hold out? How long will mercenaries stay here in the desert? Miserable. How much could they be paying them? Finally, De Silva realizes he's desperate. Right? He brings catapults. And they start to bring these, fire these ballistica up on top of the hill. You're sitting, by the way, you see this, this wood? So without the metal piping, that's what the roofs of their houses used to look like, wood. Herod had brought up all these timbers of wood. In fact, we know this because Josephus describes how they burned this and used this to burn everything before they committed suicide at the end. You're sitting down, you're sitting with your family at dinner. Take a look at one of these boulders that's up here. And imagine that one of these boulders comes flying through the roof. And you couldn't walk out in an open area and you didn't know what to do. Terrifying experience. One day the Jews wake up and the Romans are moving piles of dirt. Okay? And they can't figure out what they're doing. And this is going on for days and days and days. And first they think they're building a wall, but they already have a wall. And then they think they're using it for the catapult, but they're not using it for the catapult. I don't know how long it takes them. A day? A week? A month? 3 months? And eventually, they realize what they're building. And this thought terrifies them. Come follow me, we'll sit down. How did the Romans bring all of these supplies for 15,000 men? Understand that this was De Silva's biggest problem. In addition to the fact that they minted a coin, which expressed the fact, don't you appreciate this more after standing there? Yeah. Right? In addition to the fact that the Romans had minted coins and that they had to put down this rebellion, De Silva was getting enormous pressure from the Roman Senate because this was costing a fortune. This was depleting the coffers of Rome. And, you know, if you would have told him that it would take this long, I mean, the year is 73 already. It's 2 years. And these Jews are still up on top of the mountain. And it's like, once you grab, the Romans would have been much better off leaving them alone. They would have been much better off strengthening their forces in the area and just picking them off one at a time. But they didn't do that. So you're right. Look at these boulders. Can you imagine one of these suckers flying through your rooftop? I mean, these are the big guns. There are different theories as to whether these were made by the Romans or made by the Jews or made by Herod. And whether Herod made them, the Jews used them, and then the Romans shot them back up. They do know that some of these were absolutely shot from below because they found one in a very clear depression which could only have come from a tremendous weight landing into the ground. This blows my mind. So one day, and I'm going to show you this ramp, but it'll be in the suns. I'd rather tell you about it here. They finally realize what the Romans are building. They're building a ramp. Now, they know from past experience that the Romans do this. This is the last stage of the Roman system. If they can't break through and the siege doesn't work, they build a ramp. You build a ramp, and the top of the ramp is sort of curved this way, and it can support a rolling battering ram. One battering ram. Unlike the Temple Mount, where they had six. And the top of the battering ram has a platform for fighters with protection, archers, to protect the battering ram. And how do you roll the battering ram up the hill? Well, you pull it with ropes, with slaves. So the Jews are desperate again to stop the building of this ramp. And they have a simple solution. They wait till the ramp gets high enough. You know, you'll see, it's a pretty much straight drop down to where they're building. So the Jews come out with their arrows, and they just bowl these Romans down, like so many ninepins. Arrows, boulders, catapults, slingshots. You saw those little rocks at the bottom that I showed you in the display? Imagine you take one of those in the Lugatka. By the way, I want you to know, I had a unit that was Tafpe that was under my command for a while, and there were some Ethiopian soldiers there. And we were stationed in Jabali, we were stationed in Gaza, in the Gaza Strip. And these guys, these Ethiopians, they had a skill that I had never seen before. Okay? They got this from the way that they had to hunt for food in Africa. Right? They were all starving to death in Africa. And they would go out at night and they would hunt wild rabbits. And they would use slingshots, rugatkas. And there's a different type. It's not the slingshot with the V where you pull back the thing. It's a little pouch on a leather strap at the end of another thing that you hold, not a stick. And you swing it around your head. And when you turn your wrist just right, it flicks the pocket and sends this thing flying. Okay? And amazing force. And these guys were so good. I mean, imagine. Imagine you see a rabbit in the Sudan. You're on a trek to through Sudan to try to get out. You know? And you've seen a rabbit, and that's food for your family. And they will live or die based on whether you hit that rabbit. You learn how to hit the rabbit. And they could hit a moving rabbit with these rocks at like 30, 40, 50 feet. And they showed me incredible things, you know? I mean, they would like hit Coke bottles. In fact, once we had an interesting story where a bunch of kids were stoning one of the positions, and you know, you couldn't fire at them because you hit a kid, you get in trouble. So one of my guys says, I'll do that. Takes out his little rubetka, and he says, where do you want it? What do you mean, where do you want it? Well, you want his left ear, his right ear, his foot. And he aims this thing, I'm telling you, it must have been like from here to that sign, okay? And he had this weird way of doing an underhand, and he sends a rock, and all of a sudden you see this kid scream, and his leg just buckled out from under him, and he hit him in the shin. You ever bang your shin bone? Do you know what it is to get a rock at like 50 miles an hour hit your shin bone? You're finished. And they did this to like two or three kids, and that's it. The whole riot broke up. It's unbelievable. So I imagine these guys had that skill. Like, it sounds crazy, but maybe they could do that. So they're firing slingshots and everything down, arrows, and they're killing the Roman legionnaires and the auxiliary workers. So Da Silva is confounded. Will they never cease to find a way? We can't do this. Every time we find a solution, they... So actually, work on the ramp stops for almost a week. And then one day, Da Silva figures it out. And work resumes. And Ben Yair calls his archers, and they come out, and they see them building, and they can't do anything. They don't know what to do. Why? Because they've taken Jewish slaves. They have Jewish slaves, and the Jewish slaves are now building the ramp. So what do you do?
How can they tell?
You're up here on top of the hill. Good question. You're up here on top of the hill, and the fortress, and your own brothers and sisters, captured maybe from Jerusalem, maybe your cousin. If you don't shoot, you know the Rome is going to make it up here, and your families are going to be destroyed. If you do shoot, you're going to kill your fellow Jew. Can you do it? It's interesting, by the way, halachically speaking, you are not allowed to do it, and that's what they choose to do. These were, by the way, absolutely dedicated halachic Jews. They learned Torah. Interesting question David asked. How did they know from this distance that they were Jewish? Now, the Medrash says that there were three things that protected the Jewish people in Egypt. How for 200 years do we keep our identity as the sons of Yaakov? So it says that there were three things that they used to do. They kept their names, Jewish names. You know, you think your name is Andy. And it's a nice name. If your parents call you that, that's your name. But you also have another name. Avram Simcha. And Avram is a name that was given to you because someone in your family was named Avram, who was given that name because someone in his name was named Avram, all the way back to Avram. We kept our names. We kept our language. I mean, little Yair, if he went back in time, he could talk to these Jews, because we speak the same language. Any Jew anywhere in the world can walk into any synagogue and say Shalom, and they'll know what he means. Right? And they kept their dress. Now what that means is an interesting discussion, but let's say at the little, they had tzitzit, they had four-cornered garments, they had not kippot, they didn't wear kippot back then, we don't think, but they had a mode of dress, a Jewish dress. A modest form of dress, and you could recognize them from a distance. And they had this 2,000 years ago, and that's how they recognized them as Jews. So they get to this point, and the ramp is being built, and the Romans are coming up on top of the ramp, and then they set the battering ram to work. And the battering ram, you saw that ram's head, that battering ram, must have been a terrifying thing. Huge, huge battering ram, suspended by ropes, pulled by slaves, smashing into the wall, and eventually it starts to break the wall of the top of the fortress. It always amazed me that they built a wall. Who would need a wall up here? But Herod was fanatic about these things, and it proved that he was correct. You needed a wall, because you were fighting Rome. Can you imagine what it did to the morale of the Jews up here to realize what a dedicated enemy that was so dedicated to their destruction, they were willing to build a ramp so high, spend years in the desert. For what? For a few hundred Jews. One day, the battering ram is working on this wall and breaks through it. And a part of the wall crumbles, and it's very clear that the end is near. And the Romans, the night comes, they didn't fight at night, it was too dangerous, because one zealot slips in amongst the Romans and can wreak havoc. So they retire down to their base camp for the night, certain that the next morning, end is at hand. And they go up the next morning, but meanwhile, Elazar ben Yair has a plan. Behind the crumbling wall, he takes beams of wood from the rooftops, and he builds a wall of wood. And he packs earth up against it and builds a second wall of wood. And he fills the gap with earth. Now, if you take a battering ram against a wall of wood filled with earth, what happens when the battering ram hits? It just makes it tighter, because the wood absorbs the blow. So the next morning they come up, and they're determined, they break through the wall, and they find a wall of wood. And they start battering the wall of wood, and they realize it's not working. It takes them a day. And again, the Romans are demoralized. The Jews keep coming up with these solutions, and we're never going to defeat them. And then De Silva comes up with an obvious plan. What do? You burn it. So they take arrows full of fire, and they light the wall on fire. And when they light the wall on fire, with the battering ram up top, and the siege ramp there, right, a wind comes and blows the fire so that it grows to amazing fire, and then the wind blows the fire on the Roman siege tower, threatening to set it on fire. That's what Josephus writes. And the men scatter before this raging fire, and De Silva's spirits fall, and the Roman pagan mercenaries start to think maybe the God of the Hebrews will protect them, and what are we doing here? And for 5 minutes this goes on, complete havoc, complete disarray, and then the wind changes direction. And it begins to blow the fire this time back onto the siege wall with a new force. And the entire siege wall goes up in smoke. Now, archaeologists read this story in Josephus. Because winds don't change direction. They don't blow this way and then that way and then this way. It doesn't work that way. Until Yigal Yadin is sitting here in 1965. And he used to read sections of Josephus to the volunteers, to the students at night. They're sitting up on top of the mountain late one afternoon. And the wind is blowing. And all of a sudden the wind, which was a westerly wind, starts blowing eastwards. And then it changes directions. It blows that way. And then changes directions again and blows back this way. Something to do with the contours of the valley. And Yigal Yadin notices this, and his face takes on this excited look. And the students don't understand what's going on. And he picks up dirt and starts throwing the dirt up in the air and watching which way it's blowing. And the students look at him like he's nuts. And then he explains to them, up until this moment, I was convinced we were in the right place. Now I know we're in the right place. Because this is exactly what Josephus describes. That night, the wall in ruins. The Romans prepared to storm the next morning. And Elazar ben Yair realizes that the end is near. And so he gathers his men together, and he reads them one last speech. And he tells them, you know, we entered this because we refused to be slaves. It's clear that the end is near, and we have a choice. And we can choose whether to die as free men or live as slaves. Let us end our life with our free choice, rather than see our wives and our women and children become slaves to the Romans. And they decide to do this. And they choose 10 men with lots. And these 10 men have the terrible task of going family to family and helping people to put themselves to death so that the Romans won't capture them. We don't know if all these people did this voluntarily or not. I don't know how we would ever know. But the sense you get from Josephus is that was the case. I read this section a good number of times because I was always plagued by that question. I could respect this decision even though halakhically it's challenging if I knew that there wasn't someone who was murdered. It appears that they did, but I don't know. That's a question that'll leave us hanging for a long time to come. And 10 men did this evil deed. And then the 10 men, who were obviously the commanders and the leaders, they draw lots among themselves to see who will be the one with that terrible task. That final task of killing off the other 9 and then throwing himself in his own sword. It's a hard thing to kill yourself. At least if you're killing someone else, they're not doing the act themselves. They die without having committed suicide. I'm willing to bet that's why they did it this way. Now, how do we know this story? Because the next morning, when De Silva and his men come up here, they're expecting a big battle. And they probably come up all tense. I mean, the period before a mission is a very intense thing. And it's a scary thing. And they get out here, and they begin to fan out, which is how you do it. And they leap for positions, and they don't find anybody. Just quiet. And then eventually they start to find the bodies. And eventually they realize that they've all put themselves to death. And as they're searching the Herodian palace, one of them hears a noise, and they find 2 women and 3 children hiding in the lower palace of Herod. Because they didn't want to die. And the 2 women could not bear the thought of putting their children to death. And that is how we know the story. Because they told the story of Hosanna. What you do with that in terms of fate and destiny in Judaism is an interesting question. But I will leave you with this one last thought. One day when they're doing the excavations, they find an amazing find. They find 10 pieces of potsherds, and each one has a name on it. And one of them, very clearly in Old Hebrew, has the words Ben Yair on it. Okay? Which you can find, you can see, on this potsherd, okay? Bet Nun, that's the name Ben, and the Yud in the middle, Yair. Ben Yair.
Like a piece of rock?
Yeah, it's a piece of potsherd.
What's a potsherd?
Like a piece of a broken piece of pottery. And the theory is, which makes a lot of sense, that is none other than Elazar ben Yair, who would naturally have been one of these 10 men. They had found, the original lots that Josephus describes. And they were found right in this room over here. Now, why here? That's a whole other discussion, which we don't have time for. I'm going to show you 2 or 3 more things before we go down the side of the mountain. Questions?
Survivors tell the 2 women and 3 children, they told the story of the lots, or did somebody have to sort of figure that whole thing out when they found them?
That is a good question. You can read the whole story in Josephus. Which story came from them and which story the Romans pieced together and which story we figured out later on is an interesting question.
And that's amazing that they let those people live, too.
Right.
Did they take them?
By the way, one more thing in terms of the bodies, right? So you wonder where all the bodies went. Well, this place was inhabited later by Byzantine monks. The Romans actually set up a garrison here for about 50 years before they finally abandoned it for political reasons. Fortress, you know, position, for reasons that have nothing to do with Jews. I would imagine that if you're running an army base, you don't kind of keep the bodies around, you get rid of them. What they did with them, burn them. However, what's interesting is that in the lower part of the Herodian palace, all the way at the bottom, okay, they excavated 2 bodies, 2 skeletons. And, as a matter of fact, remind me afterwards, I'll show you in the book. These two skeletons were so well preserved. We know that one was a man, one was a woman. The woman's hair, braided hair, was still in her skull. Black braided hair. That's how well it was preserved by the desert air. I'll show you the picture afterwards if you want to see it. And they're lying dead. He is lying near a sword. And their hands are intertwined. And one theory, I don't know how you go about proving this, but this was Yadin's theory, is that this might well have been the last man who threw himself on his own sword and would most probably have gone to lie near his loved ones. Which is just mind-boggling. So when you talk about the legend of Masada, we absolutely know, this is one of the few things the archaeologists, the rabbis, they all agree on. We know that this story happened. We know it happened pretty much as Josephus said. What we're left to struggle with is the how and the why. Yes?
You said there were about 900 people here at one time?
940, 960. By the way, you know the way I remember the number, the reason I know it was 960? It's one of those little pieces of trivia that just stays in your mind. Because the number of people who were up on top of Masada, the exact same number, 963, as the number of people on the boat St. Louis, which was the last boat to set sail from Germany before the Holocaust, was a terrible story. Now, what you do with that, I have no idea, but that is a fact. Yeah.
Black rock?
Yeah. Those were cooking rocks.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. In fact, the theory is that they did then what we do today as Arabs. The Arabs make pita, spread it out over a round rock like that. Okay, come follow me. Let me show you one thing. Come over here. So I'll just show you one interesting thing. You asked me a question, right? So you know what? Let's go in here and then I'll show you this because another group will come along. Come. Where's the guitar? When you come in, which way do you face? You're facing west, actually northwest. Jerusalem. This was the synagogue.
Wow.
2,000 years ago, they davened here. This is absolutely the place where Elazar ben Yair, the only public meeting place. This is absolutely the place where Elazar ben Yair gathered the men. And the last night, 100 plus, and they sat here and they discussed what to do. What's missing here?
No Aaron.
No Aaron, right? There's a book called the Sefer HaMinhagim. 1,000 years ago, describes an ancient custom. They didn't used to have an ark in the center of the synagogue. That's a custom we developed from being in exile. Christians, Muslims, whatever. And what they used to do is they used to have the ark in another room. You know, we read the verse, Vayihi bin Tzoah Aaron, when the ark traveled, right? Then Moshe called, Kuma Hashem v'yafutu evecha, arise God, scatter your enemies. They used to have the ark in another room, and when it was time to read the Torah, they would pick it up and carry it in. And that's what they found here. This is one of the oldest synagogues in the world. And that's how we know that custom is true. Now, when they were doing the archaeology, they split up into different groups. And one of the groups, right, one of the groups was working in this place, and they realized it was a shul. It's very clear at the synagogue. And they were doing a little digging. And in that room, they found something. And it looked like scrolls. They got very excited. And just as they were preparing to dig away the earth so that they could carefully remove it, right, the fellow who was leading the expedition, a fellow named Musa, right? So Musa, right, discovered that there were scrolls. He was called away to commando mission. The whole camp was in sort of suspense. He begged Yigal Yadin to wait until he got back. So then they finally, he got back after 2 days, he was a naval commando. They dug up the scrolls. And they pulled them out of the ground. And they found the entire book of Ezekiel. They found two scrolls that were clearly from Qumran. They found whole sections of the Torah. These were their holy books. You see, when the Romans, right in that room over there. You see, when the Romans were about to storm the mountain, the Jews wanted to destroy everything. Before they killed themselves, they didn't want the Romans to get their loot. The only thing they left behind was the food. They didn't want to give the Romans their weapons, but they didn't want them to think that they'd killed themselves because they were starving themselves to death. So they burned everything but the food. But what do you do with your holy books? They used to learn Torah here. So they buried them in the ground. Now think about this. In order to bury them in the ground, you have to believe that one day someone's going to come back to dig them up. 2,000 years later, the Jewish people finally came home. And we brought the words, which had been hidden so long, as such an unbelievable act of faith, out of the ground. You sit in a synagogue like this, and it's just mind-boggling. So I think there's a better place in the world for a niggun. I don't know it. Must have been a very, very lonely time. Maybe we'll dedicate this niggun to the Jews who died here. The battle they fought. The fact that they believed that one day we'd come home. And the unbelievable joy that we're still here. You guys know the song? Kol Olam Kulo, Geshet Tzarmad? Do you know Oseh Shalom? Alright, so we'll do something we can all sing together. You know Hinei Matovu Manaim? So Hinei Matovu Manaim, how good and pleasant it is that brothers should sit together, right? We're in a synagogue. If we could only all learn to sit together, right? Hinei Matovu Manaim Shevet Achim Gam Yachad Hinei Matovu Manaim Shevet Achim Gam Yachad Hinei Matov, Hinei Matov Na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na Hinei Matov, Hinei Matov Na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na Hinei Matov, O Manaim Shevet Achim Gam Yachad Hinei Matov, O Manaim Shevet Achim Gam Yachad Hinei Matov, Hinei Matov Na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na Hinei Matov, O Manaim Shevet Achim Gam Yachad Hinei Matov, O Manaim Shevet Achim Gam Yachad Hinei Matov Shevet Achim Gam Yachad Hinei Matov Shevet Achim Gam Yachad I don't want to take up time. I want this group to be able to enjoy this place. I wish you guys an incredible journey. Enjoy your trip. Now you are from Argentina, you are in Israel. Come home to Israel. Okay, I don't know what you just said, but it sounds good. Oh, Brazil! Itchem haslicha, beseder, Brazil. Got it. See this? They're actually going to build this into a whole... they're rebuilding it now. Oh, they already rebuilt it. They built up the walls. They're going to put an ark here. There's going to be a Torah scroll here. Come. No, I'm serious. I was actually with the group that dedicated it. Israelite this way. Okay, we're not going to stop here. I'm going to show you something quickly because it's hot out. But remember I told you they built the ramp. And they eventually broke through the wall. This is the actual spot where they breached the wall. When you go up to that fence, you can see the breach in the wall. And look down, you can see the ramp. And you understand the fanatic dedication of the Romans to destroying the Jews that were up here.
And how high was the wall?
Look at this. You see this? Yeah. This is a remnant of the break in the wall by the Romans. This is where they breached through, and this is the ramp. And this gives you an idea of how big the battering ram tower was.
This is the actual ramp
that they built. The entire ramp.
In the winter, you could do a ski run on it.
They just poured it, piece, pile after pile after pile. How many stories? Probably the 5 stories. Look at this. Look at how you can see where they broke through. I mean, this must have been such a painful place. Okay. I'm going to take you to see a treat. Now, this is actually a later. This is where the monks dwell. This is Byzantine. So you can see the different architecture? This is much later. This is like 5th century Christian.
And what were they doing up here? The same thing? Protecting
themselves? Yeah, they came up here to get away from Rome. You know, they don't want to read the newspapers, they don't want to see it. They want to be free. Okay. This, by the way, is the Western Palace of Herod. Got it? We're going to walk past this, but just so you see. By the way, you want to appreciate how much of a drought has been in Israel in the last 20 years. You can see that there's now a landmass that's been exposed. You can walk across the Jordan now. That's the southern part of the Dead Sea, and this is the northern part of the Dead Sea. When I came to Israel, that was all underwater. Gosh, it is amazing how much excavations they are doing here. This is all new. This sidewalk is all new. Remember I told you they used to send them into the pool? This was a swimming pool.
For us or for them?
Oh, man, I wish that was filled. Right?
It was built by Herod.
Oh,
so people who visited could have a swimming pool. And Elazar ben Yair and his men used it.
Oh, my God.
Specific people got to swim here every afternoon.
Now it's really driving me crazy down the water.
Right. I'm building it up. We're building it. They're talking about making a T-lift up here. So you can climb the ramp with a little T-bar. No, they're building it. This is one of the places the groups don't know about. Most people stay over there and then they get tired and it's, 12:30 and it's time to go up the mountain and they miss this. Which is such a shame. But it's good from the perspective of the fact that we can do what we do. This to me is one of the most amazing places on the Sabbath. So when they came here, this was already a later part of the excavation. They actually did not think that the zealots had come over this far. And you pick your issues. I mean, like I told you, personally, just a little bit that I know, we could spend a week up here. And so you got to filter, what am I going to show you? And there's a whole discussion about the archaeology and how they built differently and how you can recognize the building of the zealots versus Herod building versus Byzantine building versus... So some of you saw the architecture of the Byzantines, whatever. This is clearly a zealot building, based on the way the stones are piled. And what's amazing about this building is that they found little pieces of scroll. And they couldn't figure it out at first, because they weren't in order. It wasn't like they found the whole book of Yechezkel. They were hidden, just little pieces. And they found scripts, And they finally figured out what this place was. This place was the Beis Medrash. This is where they sat and learned. This was probably they used this to heat the room. Somebody would give shiur, would give a class, and people would sit around and listen. Okay? Now, by the way, just to put this in perspective, the two things about this that amaze me. Realize that this period, when the zealots were here, was the period of the Mishnah. Rabbi Judah the Prince, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, wasn't even born yet. He edited and compiled the Mishnah around the year 200 CE. This is 130 years earlier. I mean, this was 60 years before, or 40 years before Rabbi Akiva became famous. This was the period of... There were probably people who sat and learned Torah here who had heard classes from Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. It's unbelievable. The head of the Sanhedrin. Who had met Rabbi Shmuel Kohen Gadol. Who... It's unbelievable. So people like that, with the traditions that they had, I mean, we found tefillin here. They came down here, they're fighting a war. But just like the Jews of Gush Etzion, who continued to learn even while they were fighting, Jews have always been that way. There were secret classes, secret shiurim. People studied Talmud. Of Elchanan Wasserman, who was murdered by the Nazis in 1940 in the Kovno ghetto, was murdered because he was caught teaching Torah, teaching the tractate of Nida, the Talmud. You're sitting in a Beis Medrash from 2,000 years ago. When you read about the Mishnah and the Talmud, those people who were in the Mishnah actually sat here and learned here. And you wonder, how do you learn Torah when you're surrounded by three Roman legions? Maybe we'll leave him in Igan. Because here it's not so hot. And the Argentinians aren't waiting to conquer the world. Nine, Figure if we can sit up here and sing, and that's my answer. You know, 2,000 years ago, did they die for nothing? Really up to us. Today, they didn't die for nothing. Because here we are. People carry this tremendous guilt, you know. Oh, all these people died for something. Would I die for something? Soldiers dying. Would I die? All these people give up so much, not so that one day we can go join an army. They give up so much so the Jews can come to Israel and just be happy, you know? So that you can sit on Ben Yehuda Street and eat your falafel, so that we can have a cup of coffee late in the afternoon, go to the beach, and learn Torah, you know, whatever. So you don't fulfill their dream. I don't fulfill their dream when I go to the army. I'm just still struggling the same struggle. But when you come here from America, and you tour, and you enjoy, and later we'll go swimming, then you really make it worthwhile. Then it became meaningful. So this isn't about guilt. You know, people get this, gets heavy for some people. It's not about guilt. It's just about appreciation, what a gift we have that we're here. Now there are two last questions we have. One of them you didn't ask, but it is interesting, that I'm going to show you. And the other one, sort of on our way back, it's really our last stop on our way back. For those who are a little brave and want to, it's a little bit of a climb down and a climb back up, I will share with you the mystery of the water. Okay? But before we go there, I have one last treat for you. Okay? So, come follow me. This is going to blow your mind. Just blow your mind. We're going to have some fun now.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.